Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Welcome to a little wireless program called LNL, and normally I introduce a guest by giving a sort of potted bio, naming the chair of the university or the most recent book or listing off the accolades, the prizes. Not on this occasion, because there's too much stuff here to be adequately synthesised. So I'm just going to, in a sense, reveal him. It's like the dance of the seven veils. Suffice to say for the moment that he has almost certainly the loudest voice in the history of the programme. His name is Ramachandra Guha. He rejects labels like activist and environmentalist. So I asked him what labels he does accept.
Indian and liberal, in either order. It could be liberal and Indian, I don't mind, or Indian and liberal.
What about biographer? What about essayist? What about cricket writer? What about historian? What about stirrer?
I think historian is fair enough. Biographer, I've only written one serious biography. It's a bit presumptuous. Cricket writer, but then, you know, they're kind of a 300 million Indians who would like to think of themselves as cricket writers, particularly in the age of the internet and the blogs and so on. So historian, sort of, and Indian and liberal.
The book that brought you to wide attention was on ecological change and peasant resistance in the Himalayas, and was called The Unquiet Woods. It's a lovely title. It's almost like the Rachel Carson title, isn't it, about her famous spring. What was the essence of that book?
Well, that book was started as a history of the Chipko, or tree-hugging movement, which broke out in the early 1970s, where a group of peasants in the Himalayan foothills stopped a group of loggers from felling down trees that they needed for subsistence. And it was the Chipko movement was the beginnings of the Indian environmental movement, a movement that has been concerned not so much with protecting nature for its own sake or for its aesthetic beauty, as nature as a source of livelihood, water, clean air, fuel, fodder. And it started as a study of the Chipko movement. And then I found that the Chipko movement was one in a series of protests by peasants defending their rights to forests that went back to the last years of the 19th century. So it's a kind of a long sweep history of peasant discontent over forest rights.
Well, that's a major theme, of course, in your work, isn't it? Because again and again you will take a stand which would discomfort a Western greenie in favour of the people who live within the forests. Take your stand on wilderness and national parks.
Yeah, you know, I did this book on which is based on my PhD thesis called The Unquiet Woods, which you mentioned, and No sooner had I finished the thesis, not yet published the book, but finished 5 years of research on peasants and forests and the relationship between human beings and the environment they live in, a relationship that was complementary, that did not separate humans from nature. I went to the US and lived 2 years where I taught. And my students were, their frame of mind, their environmentalism, rigorously and comprehensively separated humans from nature. So to protect nature, humans had to be evacuated out of it. And that was sort of a coming from an Indian experience where we live in a densely populated land where humans have really...
There's an awful lot of humans and a diminishing amount of nature.
Yes and no. Of course, you're right on a basic level, but even there I found that, the American ethic of wilderness preservation was born out of a kind of a Protestant idea of individual guilt and individual sin. And to compensate for the destruction of the wilderness, you had to begin to love the wilderness. And I found, as a sociologist and historian, that even the diminishing amount of nature that you're talking about was the product of a whole process of urban industrial growth, in which the people, the tribal people, the forest people who lived with nature, were as much the victims as the tigers or the elephants or the beautiful butterflies. So what I tried to do was to provide a more social and historical interpretation of the environmental predicament than sort of, you know, a Protestant environmental ethic might give you.
So again and again, you would take the side of the peasant, the side of the tribal, the side of the...
Well, it started like that because I was very young. But the older I got, the more nuanced my perspective became, which is why I don't describe myself as an activist anymore. And I saw that while the American position was one extreme, perhaps there were some Indian environmentalists who disregarded the beauty and diversity of nature and were too much focused on the human rights of the people who lived in the forest. And I think over the years I've come to sort of preach a more kind of incremental middle-of-the-road environmentalism. I mean, you asked me about labels. I call myself, one label I suppose I would accept is liberal polemicist. Now, this is a contradiction in terms because the polemicists are the extremists of the left and right. And liberals generally are too soft, too modest. I am a man of moderate views, these sometimes expressed in extreme fashion. You know, the fact that I may use, you know, satire and sarcasm may sort of obscure the fact that my views are actually moderate. I'm an incrementalist. I believe in negotiation, in dialogue, in democracy, in pluralism. And hence,
let's look at another label, yeah, which I think you applied to yourself at an earlier stage, and that's Marxism. You have said that inside every thinking Indian, there's a Gandhian and a Marxist struggling for supremacy. Obviously, Marx didn't win. Did Gandhi?
Well, they're still struggling. I think Gandhi's a little bit on top inside me, but I haven't completely rejected my Marxist background. I think every scholar of modern society, be he or she a historian, analyst, a critic, a columnist, has to be a little bit of a Marxist, but not too much of a Marxist. You must read Marx to understand what modern industrial society is all about. But if you remain limited to Marx and become a dogmatist and don't read other writers who provide complementary perspectives, you'll be limited in your understanding. So they're still struggling inside me, the Gandhi and the Marx. I think the Gandhi is winning, but by a short head.
Talking about Gandhi, you wrote a book called India After Gandhi, which has been put to me as a quite generous tribute to a mostly derided class, that is, the Indian politician.
Yeah, I mean, it's my book, India After Gandhi, is a social and political history of the 60 years after independence. And in that, I argue that the real success story of India lies not in the domain of economics, namely the recent surge in economic growth, but in politics, namely the fact that India has survived as a united and somewhat democratic country against the odds. And for that survival, I give the credit to the first generation of Indian political leaders, people like Nehru and Patel and Ambedkar.
A remarkable group of men, and by any measure. Yes, well, largely men. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, one of the things that always fascinated me about contemporary Indian politics is its fluidity, the way people go into one party and emerge almost an hour later in another. That's a part of India's political dynamic, isn't it?
It is. But if you look at it in the long sweep of history, Phil, I think democracies need to be founded by visionaries. They can be run in mid-career by mediocrities. You know, the distance between Mahatma Gandhi and Sonia Gandhi is no more and no less than the distance between Thomas Jefferson and George W. Bush. You know, so
what a marvelous parallel.
So the amorality, the cynicism, the corruption, the opportunism of Indian politicians today, you know, still it is disturbed, but it has not destroyed the democratic edifice of India. We still have regular elections. We have, you know, a free and fair press. We have an independent judiciary. Because the guys who built the Indian nation state were built of a different timber.
But it would also involve, of course, the tragic balkanization after Pakistan.
Well, that happened, and we had to live with it, and which is why my book is called India After Gandhi. It could easily have been called India After Partition, because there's been a kind of obsessive emphasis by historians and scholars on the period of partition and the costs and the violence. But what happened after Pakistan was created? That's an untold but even more interesting story. One of the things that happened was that the Indian leadership, embodied particularly by the first Prime Minister Jawaharlal Nehru, was determined that, in Nehru's words, India will not be a Hindu Pakistan. You know, that is, even though Pakistan was constituted as a Muslim state, India would be a state in which church would be separate from politics and administration, and everyone, regardless of religion or gender or caste, would have equal rights. So that in my book, I've tried to show how this nation was built anew out of its fragments against the background of civil war and partition and privation and princely states and refugees, how this unified nation was created.
And, of course, it's still a work in progress, isn't it? The whole democracy movement in India is by no means static.
Indeed, it's a work in progress. It's also not a perfect democracy. just as Australia or America is not. I argue that...
What do you... You come out here and you say we're not a perfect democracy? Bloody cheek. I'm talking to the very cheeky Ramachandra Guha, who's one of the guests here at the Festival of Ideas in Adelaide. Back to you.
Yeah, I think it is a work in progress. It is, I argue in my book, a 50-50 democracy. You know, and as a citizen, you focus on the fact that the glass is half full. You try relentlessly to bridge the gap between the ideals of the Indian Constitution and the practice of Indian democracy on the ground. And you focus on the unfinished task. But as a historian, I have the liberty and the privilege and the distance and the objectivity to say, hey, it's quite a miracle that we are half full if you look around us. I mean, in Pakistan, a general election normally means the election of the generals. In China, we've had a brutal totalitarian regime. Bangladesh is a kind of quasi-Islamic state. Nepal tethers between monarchy and Maoist insurrection. And the fact that India has had 14 general elections and countless state elections, and voting percentages are in the upper 60s. You know, it's no small achievement.
To Westerners, India is, of course, an overwhelming experience, not only intellectually, but with all the senses. It's like a vast Disneyland put into a blender. We bounce around India, we get lost, we get sick, we get overwhelmed, we get exhausted. A second after we leave it, we want to go back again. I agree with the proposition that you've been putting to Adelaide, and that it is the most interesting place in the world.
Often the most exasperating place. If you're caught in a traffic jam in Bangalore, if you try to get a passport in Delhi and you have to grease the palms about 14 different touts, surely, often the most... But at all times the most interesting, I think... As a historian, as a writer, as a journalist, I'm especially blessed to live in India because it's always something going on. There's always controversy.
It's colour, never boring.
Never. Controversy, colour, you know, conflict. I mean, Jawaharlal Nehru once said, India is home to all that is truly noble and truly disgusting in the human condition. That expresses India beautifully. Truly the most noble as well as the most disgusting.
Mm.
And as a writer, you must write about both extremes. And it's there in front of you, unfolding in front of you.
I came to the view when on the program's last trip to India that it is immensely misunderstood and also underrated in the wider world. It has a population comparable to China. It has a political dynamic healthier than China. It has an economy which is rapidly emerging to be as significant as China. It has an army which... by international standards, is immense, although it has been put to me that it's all tail and not much teeth. And it's not recognised, really, as important as it is. It seems to be excluded from international dialogue or discourse. It's almost like a sideshow.
You're right, and that was also true about China till about 10 or 15 years ago. I think... The surge in the Chinese economy, the fact that the American economy now relies heavily, I mean, the budget deficit is financed by China, so to say, has made China's importance impossible to ignore. I think India's importance cannot be measured in economic terms. If you measure in economic terms, we'll always come a poor second to China. But if you measure India's importance, as you put it, because of its color and its interest and its vitality and the vigor of its democracy, it's the most interesting country in the world. It's a country every global citizen should visit again and again.
Ram, is it a superpower?
You know, I don't think it's a superpower. I don't think it. I mean, there's both a factual judgment and a value-laden judgment. I don't think it is not a superpower yet. And the value-laden judgment is, I don't believe it should become a superpower. I think these are futile ambitions that lead countries into dangerous imperialist adventures. I mean, America is a country founded on noble ideals, very democratic within its borders, you know, great achievements. You know, nowhere are individual rights as cherished and honored in America. But their desire to become a superpower has led them into all kinds of violent and bloody acts overseas, likewise with the Soviet Union. You know, who could have nurtured a socialist economy if they wanted to, but they went aggressively into Eastern Europe, later fomented a civil war in Afghanistan. So I hope, for the sake of India, Indians and the world, that India does not aspire to become a superpower.
There were moments in its recent history, including a period with Indira Gandhi, where it positioned itself as a buffer zone between superpowers, and that was a pretty useful role. I would like to see it reassume that position.
Absolutely. I think Jawaharlal Nehru had the idea of non-alignment. We were not allied to either side, and we tried each side to see the reason and to dialogue with the other. You know, India played a role in reconciling the conflicts in Korea, in the Congo, in Vietnam, and you're absolutely right. I would also like India to see the role. India can act as a bridging power between Southeast Asia and China, between America and Russia, between Europe and the rest of the world.
Between Christianity and Islam.
Absolutely, between Christianity and Islam. You know, because India, as you know, the eminent Australian historian of India, Robin Jeffrey, pointed out to me, something that had not struck me. I knew that India had the second largest Muslim number of Muslims in the world, 160 million Muslims. But he also pointed out to me that India has more Christians than Australia. Because of our size, I mean, we have 25, 30 million Christians, more than the population of Australia. And because of the plurality of religions within one national border, the plurality of languages, ways of life, cuisines, dress, I think we can show the world a path towards peaceful coexistence of cultures, which is the kind of role we should adopt. And I agree with you completely. I mean, to phrase it in kind of a more technical language, India should use and promote its soft power rather than its hard power.
We were in India at a time of national crisis. Whilst we sailed in to have a chat with your wonderful president, the untouchable president, the world media was beating him at the gates because the BJP were in negotiations. Now, this was a time of great anxiety in the rest of the world in terms of communal conflict. Would India fall apart? Would it balkanize again? And, of course, since in the era you write about, there have been tens of thousands of communal conflicts. Not great in scale, not huge, not devastating, but not insignificant. Is there being progress made in the long term in India between the two great communities of the Hindu and the Muslim?
It's a very difficult and fragile and unstable situation. I think the vast majority of Hindus and the vast majority of Muslims want to live peaceably and honorably together. And that's true of most of India. But there is a radical extremist element among the Hindus which find political representation.
Are they echoed amongst the Muslims?
Yes, yes, they are. But of course they are. There's a rising surge of Islamic fundamentalism as well. But since the Hindus outnumber the Muslims 5-1, Hindu communalism or Hindu fundamentalism in the Indian context is much more dangerous than Islamic fundamentalism. And I'm hopeful that as the economy progresses, as liberal values embrace larger sections of the population, that both kinds of fundamentalism will beat a retreat.
One of the wonderful things about India is it's the world's biggest train set. And one travels around India sensibly by train. I much prefer your trains to your airline service. And as you look out the window, you see a force that unifies the country. And that is the aforementioned game of cricket. There is not one slice of wasteland, not one sliver of earth beside a railway track in which young Indians are not playing cricket. Is this a good thing? You cricket writer, you.
It's both a good thing and a bad thing, Phil. I think, you know, there's a wonderful line of the Indian sociologist Ashish Nandi, which goes something like this. Cricket is an Indian game accidentally invented by the British. It's a lovely line. We've taken to it. I think it resonates with our sense of time. We, you know, as an agricultural civilization, we don't mind, you know, five days spent on a pursuit in which there's no result. I mean, Americans can't understand cricket because there's often a draw, no win or loss. And in the Hindu epics, there's often no result, you know. It's a draw. So it resonates with us. It's a beautiful game. It's a subtle, sophisticated game. I think there's a downside, which is that, especially when India plays Pakistan, it also promotes a kind of nasty jingoism, which can have...
Not only India playing Pakistan. There have been times when it's torn Australia and from Britain. Well, I think that's a good idea on second thoughts.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, I think sport, I mean, you know, George Orwell famously said that international sport is war minus the shooting. I think it's true that when Australia played Britain, cricket was a means of asserting a kind of superiority. I think the Australian writer Thomas Kinnerly somewhere says that we did not have Keats and Shakespeare. Keats and Shakespeare, but Trumper had scored a century before lunch, you know, which no Englishman had done. So it's a way of settling accounts, but that's not the same when India plays Pakistan. You know, it gets transformed into a Hindu-Muslim kind of conflict, which is disturbing.
Well, I was wondering whether it bridged the coast cultures. It does not.
Within India, it does. So, the Indian cricket team has North Indians and South Indians and Hindus and Sikhs and Christians and low caste and high caste and so on. When you look at the following of the game, it's not an elite game. The working class follows it, the peasants follow it, the women follow it in increasing numbers. But it binds the nation together within its boundaries. But when that nation is pitted against Pakistan, with whom India has fought three wars, then it leads to these kind of nasty jingoistic sentiments.
There are a great many football codes played in Australia. There is a sort of one that could be loosely described as indigenous. It derives from an Irish game, apparently, and it's called Australian Rules. Now, I never talk about sport on this program. It's the one topic we never touch. But a couple of weeks ago, I spoke for an hour to a very great football figure. And we agreed that it had one virtue, and that was it enabled people to escape the humblest of origins, the most oppressed of origins. It enables, for instance, kids from remote Aboriginal communities to become stars in the major cities. Does cricket have that function in India as well? Does it allow... Are there untouchable cricketers, for example?
There were, historically. As it happens, the first great family of Indian cricketers, so to say, are Chappells and our Gregories, but a family of untouchable cricketers from Western India called the Palwankar brothers. And I've written about them in my book, A Corner of a Foreign Field. I've described their rise from obscurity, much like the Aboriginal football players or the American athletes like Jesse Owen or Michael Jordan. But after them, it's been mostly a middle class and lower middle class game. I think not enough untouchables or really poor people have got into playing cricket. Though they follow cricket, the Indian cricket team is largely composed of sort of white-collar, people from white-collar backgrounds.
Ram, I saw the other day a story, only a little story in our media, of sizable numbers of untouchables who are converting to other faiths, principally, I understand, to Islam, as a method of escaping predestination, this extraordinary form of traditional oppression.
Well, I don't think they are sizable numbers. I think historically they have. Through the medieval period, many low castes converted to Islam. During the period of colonial rule, many low castes converted to Christianity. Then in the 1950s, under the leadership of the great untouchable leader B.R. Ambedkar, who also drafted the Indian constitution, some untouchables converted to Buddhism. So there is... So there is some interesting conversion going on. But more than the conversion to another faith, there's a kind of political assertiveness of untouchables to their own political parties. There's a party called the Bahujan Samaj Party, the BSP, which is led by a remarkable ex-untouchable woman called Mayawati, who, as we speak, serves as chief minister of India's most populous state, Uttar Pradesh, which has a population more than France and Germany combined. And she is from an untouchable background, and her social base is largely... those of untouchables. So the untouchables have very effectively used the democratic political system.
This is proving my thesis that the best way to deal with you is just to chat as aspects of your activities, not your activism. It's a label you reject. Then are revealed. You are a columnist for a very, very impressive newspaper. Tell us about it.
Well, I actually write two columns. I write a column for The Hindu, which is the leading paper, English paper in South India, which is a history column called Past and Present, which, uses some parallels between past and present. If Sachin Tendulkar gets has a row of three ducks in succession, I might console the Indian readers by reminding them of some ducks Bradman got in the 1930s. So that's the kind of column The Hindu column is. I also write a fortnightly political column in The Telegraph, which is the leading newspaper of Eastern India, published out of Kolkata. And in that column, I comment more on contemporary political social issues.
It, of course, is a puzzlement to people outside India that English is still such a dominant and influential language. Clearly comes out of the Raj, but it lingers on and strengthens itself.
Yes, and I think that's good, because I think English acts as a link language between the different states, which have, of course, as you know, India is a nation composed of states based on language. So we have 16 major languages, and each language has its own province. to take care of the interests of the speakers of the language. But English is a link language, and like the Raj, as you mentioned, I think, you know, the Raj had some many nasty effects on India, but among its beneficent effects were the railways, which you've already mentioned, the English language.
The bureaucracy.
Well, the bureaucracy is a mixed blessing, but and the game of cricket. And English and Hindi is also emerging as a link language, which is spoken, which is more at a mass level, and English at an elite level. But it's certainly true that not only do Indians use English widely and ubiquitously, they use it with, you know, rare originality.
Let's talk about an English man who you have devoted much of your attention to, much of your historical energies to, because as I see him through your filter, I must say I find him fascinating, but I doubt that many, indeed perhaps not any, of my listeners know about Elwin. Tell us about Verrier Elwin.
Verrier Elwin was born in England in 1902, the son of a bishop of Sierra Leone. His father died early, and then he was left in the care of his devoted but somewhat possessive and strong-willed mother, who fully intended that her son would follow the father and maybe exceed him. So she sent him to a evangelical school and then to Oxford, where Elwin got first-class degrees in theology and in English. I think a double first at Oxford is an extraordinary intellectual achievement. So he was clearly a precociously brilliant kid. And the mother would, and he got ordained as a priest, and I'm sure if he'd followed the family line, he would have ended up as Archbishop of Canterbury or York, but he did something more interesting, partly to escape his mother, and partly because he had read about India and was entranced by the idea of India, came to India in 1927 at the height of the Raj. But instead of converting India to the Christian faith, he became converted to India. He joined Mahatma Gandhi, became a nationalist, then on Gandhi's advice, went to live among tribal people in central India, and they rebelled against Gandhi. He was a kind of serial rebel, and that's one of the things that attracts him to me. He was also not someone who could be pigeonholed. So he rebelled against Gandhi, came to embrace the...
What was the rift with Gandhi?
Well, the rift with Gandhi was partly, well, it was about those two elemental human desires, sex and alcohol. But I'll put it more precisely. Elwin went to live with tribal people, and the tribal people of India, who are not very well known outside, live in the central Indian forest. They are linked to the broader Hindu peasant society, but are also distinct from it. They have their own literature, their folklore, their music, their dance, their love of beauty, and also alcohol is part of their, as part of their festivities. And Gandhi wanted to introduce prohibition in tribal communities. He also insisted that his co-workers like Elwin be celibate, or brahmachari, as the Indian word goes, and Elwin wanted to marry. He married a tribal girl and then wrote a series of wonderfully moving ethnographies and novels based on the tribal predicament. I mean, not dissimilar to the Aboriginal predicament here. A once beautiful, dignified, vivacious culture torn apart and degraded by its encounter with a much more technologically powerful industrial civilization. And Elwin became the best-known anthropologist and the best-known spokesperson for tribal rights. He was also the first foreigner to be granted Indian citizenship. And he lived on till 1964 and died actually a man full of honors in his adopted land. He was dignified with the Padma Bhushan, which is India's third highest civilian honor.
I love the title of your book, Savaging the Civilized.
Yeah, it's a play on... it's a play on Elwin's polemic against industrial society for its exploitation of tribals. So savaging the civilized, attacking the civilized, but also savaging the civilized in the sense of giving the civilized world, you know, humanizing it with some of the values and the beauty and the poetry of tribal life.
Given Gandhi's intensely prim attitude towards sexuality and Elwin's generous and creative attitude towards sexuality. Did they ever resolve this difference? Was there a rapprochement?
They didn't, because Elwin felt very bad about it, because he was very close to Gandhi. And I think he admired many other aspects of Gandhian thought. For example, Gandhi's nonviolence, Gandhi's religious pluralism, Gandhi's emphasis on reconciliation, Gandhi's a belief that the rich must make reparation for the poor, that the colonizer must make reparation for the colonized. I think there are many aspects of Gandhian thought he admired, but this rift was never healed, and after Gandhi died, Elwin wrote about it. He said that, you know, he felt that in Gandhi's lifetime, particularly Gandhi's last years, which were spent, as you know, working tirelessly and heroically to solve the Hindu-Muslim problem. Elwin felt that in Gandhi's best years, he was torn apart from the man whom he may have disagreed with on specific issues and specific policy, but the man, nonetheless, he revered almost as a father.
Mm. Well, Elwin deserves to be more widely known because he's so fascinating.
It is, and I had great fun writing the book. You know, Phil, I mean, as a writer, as a broadcaster, you move on from topic to topic, you know, person to person. But the time I felt felt bereft was when I finished the index to my Elwin book and sent it off to the publisher, because I'd lived with Elwin for so long. Elwin was actually, something I don't reveal in the book, was very much part of my own life. You know, I was a cricketer. I'm a failed cricketer. At the age of 20, between the ages of 11 and 21, I was motivated by the single ambition to play cricket for India. And there were two problems with that ambition. One was that 60 million Indians shared it. And the other, and more fundamental problem, was that I wasn't good enough. At 21, I discovered I wasn't good enough to play cricket for India. And it so happened that when I was not chosen for the university team, I stumbled upon Elwin and decided that anthropology and history would be the career for me. So Elwin was fundamental to my own career and my shift. And when I finished that Elwin book, I felt a wrench. You know, which sort of...
This is a story that Bollywood should tell in redemption. This should be a great Indian movie, co-pro with India and Britain.
I think terrific. I think if you could find the right person to play Elwin and his tribal wives and Gandhi, I think the problem with that story is that it doesn't have a dramatic ending. You know, the story, but the last 8 or 10 years of his life are lived as a kind of a successful anthropologist in independent India, with, you know, widely published, widely travelled, listened to man.
I don't think happy endings. And this sounds quite happy. I don't think happy endings are forbidden. Are they in the canons of cinema? I'd like to see a film.
Yes.
I'd love to see a film with a happy ending. This is Late Night Live, ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, downloadable onto your pod, etc. And my guest is Ramachandra Guha. On the day that I cracked it for a long interview, an afternoon tea with the president, when the rest of the world was locked outside the palace gates, incidentally, we got in because he'd spent quite a lot of time in Australia.
Yes.
And viewed us with some warmth. As we went through the various layers of security further and further and further into that great building that looms over Delhi, everywhere, images of Gandhi. It became almost a joke. There was Gandhi's greatest hits, would you believe? There was, you know, there was actually those gold records framed on a wall. There were statues of Gandhi. There were memorabilia of Gandhi. And, of course, that's echoed outside the palace as well. It's hard to find a building without an image of Gandhi. But it's very hard to find Gandhi.
Yeah, that's certainly true. I think the Indian state, which pretends to honour Gandhi and calls him the father of the nation, has repudiated many of his policies. The people in public office, you know, are often corrupt and dishonest. A friend of mine, who's a great Gandhi scholar, once in one of his bleak moods told me, he said, "We threw out the Buddha and we'll throw out Gandhi as well." And the Buddha is known everywhere else. You know, the Buddha was Indian, but no, very few Indians follow him. And there are many great Gandhians outside India. You think of Aung San Suu Kyi or Nelson Mandela or Martin Luther King or Václav Havel and many other lesser-known, you know, tireless workers for human rights and environmental protection and all that, all the kind of things Gandhi stood for. They're mostly outside India.
There's an opportunity for born-again Gandhism then, isn't there?
There is, and there was actually a successful...
You could have a national leader like George Bush, except he embraces Gandhi.
And that. There was a film on that topic, interestingly, Phil. There was a Bollywood film made recently about why Gandhi must revive. And it did give rise to a brief revival of Gandhism. But at the level of public policy and professional practice, regrettably, Gandhi is generally absent.
I'd like to end our discussion by going back to Marx. And as you said, inside every thinking Indian, a Gandhian and a Marxist struggling for supremacy. Recently, while I was away on a brief holiday, we had a discussion on the Naxalites, on this Maoist insurgent group. Now, I wish I'd been there for it, because one of the things which has always made my head ache when I think about India is the failure of communism in a country which one would have thought would have been open, ready for it. We know that there's there was an experiment, an ongoing experiment in one state, in Kerala.
Yeah.
But India should have gone communist, it seems to me, at least for a while, but didn't. Leaving that aside, now the Naxalites, a Maoist insurgent group.
Yeah, the rise of the Maoist insurgent group is linked to the tribal people whom Elwin wrote about and whom we spoke about. In the heart of India, there are about 50 million tribal people who've had the good luck in the past and the misfortune in the present to live along India's fastest flowing rivers, its most verdant forests, and on top of its most rich mineral resources. In the past, they had control over these resources to sustain their largely agricultural lifestyle. Now those resources have, are eyed avariciously by the expanding global and national economy. So their dams being built on their rivers, which drown their lands, their forests are being harvested, depriving them of their game. The mines are being, the ore is being excavated under the land they live. And something like 8 or 10 million tribals have been dispossessed as a result of dams, mines, and commercial forests.
Sorry, what's the figure again?
Well, these are varying estimates. Close to 8 million tribals probably have been dispossessed. And that's where the Naxalites have moved in. The Naxalites have seized an opportunity among the most disadvantaged and dispossessed people in India who have not shared in India's economic boon and, to the contrary, have lost out because of India's economic boon.
So fertile ground for a Maoist
Absolutely.
Insurgent group.
Yeah. And having said that, the Maoists, you can see why they are they have gained steady ground and gained a foothold in the tribal areas. But the methods they practice are savage. They behead alleged informers, they bomb police stations, they even destroy railway lines. So I don't know how that's going to help the poor, but it is a serious security problem which the Indian government, I think, doesn't recognize the root of. They would rather treat it as a law and order question. It is partly a law and order question. You can't allow armed insurrection in a democracy, but it is also partly a socio-economic problem, namely the fact that the tribal people who provide the support base for the Naxalites have been most hard done by recent processes of economic development.
You wrote a fine essay in The Nation, A War in the Heart of India. This war is so little known outside India.
It's even little known inside India, Phil, because you can travel from Delhi, which is the political capital of India, to Bangalore, my hometown, which is the economic capital of India, and you overfly this area. 1,000 miles below you in that plane, is this war between Naxalites and vigilante groups promoted by the state, with the tribals caught squeezed in between. But if you go to Delhi, you think of India as an emerging superpower. We talked about that. You come to Bangalore, we think of India as, the Silicon Valley of the world. But in the heart of India, there's a civil war being conducted outside the gaze, not only of the wider world, but outside the gaze of the Indian media, the Indian intellectuals, large sections of the Indian political class.
A complete change of direction. How do you feel about the infatuation of the West, the love affairs, plural, that the West has with India over and over and over again, the sudden desire to find the perfect guru in India, the almost excessive enthusiasm currently for the Bollywood movies, the number of English novelists who have written obsessively about India, the success of Indian novelist writing in English in the outside world. This is really a strange series of attachments.
It is. I have mixed feelings about it. Obviously, I welcome the growing interest in India. I'm not sure that I like the enchantment for Godman, but I approve, obviously, as a self-interested writer, if people are buying more books written by Indian writers. I think the quote from Nehru that I offered a little while ago, that India is home to all that is truly noble and truly disgusting in the human condition. There was an earlier generation of Western observers, Winston Churchill, for example, who only noticed the truly disgusting. And it would be a mistake for current Western observers to go to the other extreme and only notice the truly noble. I think India is a peculiar mixture of extraordinary creativity and brilliance, and at the same time indignity and humiliation which Indians heap on the less fortunate members of their own nation.
But there is a tendency on my side of the world to Disneyfy India and to see the colour and the movement,
yeah,
and the sort of the intoxication of India, but very little beyond that.
Well, I would say so. I think, you know, they are, I mean, maybe that's true of the traveller, but there have been many fine Western writers on India. I mentioned Robin Jeffrey, who lives in Australia, and who's written a series of quite marvellous books, thoughtful, insightful books on contemporary Indian politics. We talked about the communist experiment in Kerala, and Robin's book, Politics, Women and Wellbeing, is probably the finest work written on Indian politics by a Western academic. So I think you need to go there for long periods. You need to soak yourself. You need to understand the nuances and the complexities. You need to travel to different parts of the country and you know, spend more time in what is the most interesting country in the world.
The Indian diaspora is another interesting phenomenon. Wherever you wander in the world, you will find a sizable Indian community. Now, the Chinese diaspora has a very strong influence as a bridge between the West, mainland China, Taiwan, Hong Kong. Does the Indian diaspora have the same role or relationship with India?
When you speak of the Indian diaspora, Phil, there are two elements to it. The Indian diaspora that is visible and successful and recent, which is the engineers and the doctors who have migrated to the West in the last 20 or 30 years. But there's an older Indian diaspora, which is that of workers and indentured labor shipped out by the British to the Caribbean, to Fiji, to South Africa. And
they
even
had
Indi-
no choice in it, did they?
They had no choice. And somehow Indians forget that older Indian diaspora because they lack the money. The new Indian diaspora has wealth, has influence. They're probably not given back as much to India as the Chinese diaspora has. But that's now changing. I think there was a time when they, you know, so to say, you know, bit the hand that fed them. You know, they had very fine education at state-subsidized schools in India and then went to the US or to Australia to pursue their professional careers. Now I think there's a greater appreciation of what India stands for, the vitality of its democracy, its economic needs and requirements, and I think slowly the Indian diaspora is beginning to give back to India.
I was in profound shock when I revisited Mumbai. I had never seen so many S-series Mercedes anywhere on earth. I had never seen more preposterously flamboyant restaurants. The Saatchi and Saatchi culture was everywhere. But the S-series Mercedes were pushing through the beggars, the people having these million-dollar meals were in terrible contrast to the people sleeping on the footpaths. Does that, are you inured to that, or does it continue at some level to shock you too?
No, I think it is, I think, disturbing, the kind of vulgar display of consumerism that's now abroad. But it's partly to do with the fact that Indians were deprived for so long. You know, because we had an insular, self-sufficient economy, all kinds of Western goods were kept out, and now they come in. But at the same time, there is a kind of amorality to Indian social practice. I think the caste system, it does inure you. You know, you're indifferent to the beggars, to the suffering, to the deformed. I think one of the nice things about Christianity, and indeed even about Islam, is the whole question of charity. You know, in Islam, there's the zakat, the tax, that a portion of your income has to be given as charity to the poor. And in Hinduism, there's no such concept. So I suppose all we Hindus are, to some extent, guilty of indifference to the poor and the disadvantaged. Part of it is emulation of what they think is happening in the West. And the way to be truly modern is to have an S-class Mercedes, you know, rather than be plural and liberal.
I'm not being judgmental so much as observing something which does astonish. But the other thing one also notices in India, that even amongst the most oppressed, I would put in brackets, not Sanat's suiciding farmers, but almost everyone else, there is such a vibrance. People don't give up in India. They don't capitulate. They don't resign.
Well, I think that's true of the poor everywhere, Phil. I think the poor, people who have been dumped upon, it's also true of women. You know, women are much more resilient than men because they've suffered so much more. I mean, they can take so many more knocks and yet, you know, stand up and carry on. And the poor generally are resilient. So I would treat it as a peculiarly Indian phenomenon.
Well, I partially accept that, but it seems to me, for example, I spent a couple of days in Varanasi interviewing the people who were burning the bodies on the ghats. Now, here you would expect to find people whose lives were overwhelmingly full of gloom and despair. Not for a second. Wonderful characters. You know, extraordinary. Anyway, I won't dwell on it, but I want to go back to an issue I raised and we just passed over when we got to the Naxalites. When you think of the historical India, 20th century India, you think of the vast scale of its social problems. Why do you think that communism did not, in fact, become a major factor?
Well, it has at various periods threatened to become a major factor. When we became independent in 1947, shortly afterwards, there was a communist insurrection launched under the orders of Joseph Stalin, which started in March 1948, and which is described at some length in my book, India After Gandhi. And the center stood firm. Nehru and Patel and the other Congress-led ministers of the government made sure that the democratic infrastructure stayed robust, and they successfully vanquished the communist challenge. And then the communists entered the parliamentary mainstream, so that when they came to power in Kerala in 1957, it was through the ballot box. So I think that democracy slowly took root. And I think, despite the extreme poverty, I think the Gandhian ideal of reconciliation and dialogue, which in some ways Nehru transformed into the democratic ethos of independent India, appealed to most people. And I think by the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, we had enough information about the gulags and the brutalities in Russia and China, and most Indians were reluctant to follow that path.
Something I couldn't help but notice and marvel at is the very long shelf life of many Indian politicians. In our country, you have a use-by date, which is when you often leave power in your mid-50s, or yes. When our Prime Minister finally leaves, okay, he'll be pushing 70. But generally, politicians don't last that long. In India, they can live forever.
I forget who it was who said, it may not have been an Indian, power is the greatest aphrodisiac.
Henry Kissinger,
okay. And well, you can
I don't think he's Indian.
That's right. But it applies to India, I think, certainly. And you're quite right. The chief minister of Tamil Nadu, the largest southern state, is 83. The man who hopes to be the next BJP prime minister, may he never become prime minister, is Lal Krishna Advani, who's pushing 82. the man who's fighting for president, Bairav Singh Shekhawat, is already 87, so that when he finishes his presidential term, if he's elected, it's unlikely.
You don't need reincarnation in India. You can stay in the one incarnation.
That's right. It is a problem. I think they should retire. I think there are two things that would really cleanse Indian democracy and restore some of the original idealism and fire and honesty to Indian democracy. Firstly, a retirement age, say 70 or 75. Secondly, a bar against children of politicians entering politics.
Dearie, that would have excluded at least two of the Kennedys, wouldn't it, as well?
Well, I think in India, every political party has become a family firm. Indira Gandhi started the process by anointing first her son Sanjay, and when Sanjay died, her other son Rajiv. But other political leaders have followed her, and except for the BJP and the communists, every political party in India is a family firm, and I think politicians' progeny are a curse. They should be kept out of politics.
Ram, I would have thought that India's escalating economy would be sapping political energy to some extent, that the young can now aspire to the toys, they can aspire to the trinkets of affluence rather than political activism.
It is to some extent, and it's also drawing capable people out of politics into entrepreneurship, out of politics and public service. For example, the kinds of brilliant science graduates who would have earlier joined the Indian civil service, now join Infosys or Wipro, which are our major software companies. So it is also it's not only sapping political energy and idealism, it's also depriving the political and state sector of talent and intelligence.
I'm sitting in a hotel room with Ramachandra Guha, and we're having a wide-ranging chat on and around matters Indian, and it's a little wireless program called Late Night Live on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, downloadable onto your pod. And in parenthesis, are there lots of poddies in India, people who listen to podcasts?
No, there are lots of iPods, but...
Same thing.
But sadly, radio broadcasts don't feature. It's mostly music that they listen to.
The great clash of civilizations, alleged, apparent, whatever, can also be observed with a degree of detachment, oddly enough, by India. When you look at what we loosely call the Christian world confronting Islam, what's the Indian perspective?
Overall, I think we would see it as a simplification of a larger complex process. I think Gandhi himself would have been appalled by it, because I think the Gandhian way and the way promoted by the Indian constitution and certainly by large sections of Indian society, that it is that religious faith is a private affair and people of different religious orientations can very comfortably and peaceably live together. But there are sections on the Hindu right, for example, who would talk about, who would approve of the idea of class of civilizations and would want to line up alongside the Christian fundamentalists against the Islamic fundamentalists. But that's a minority view, but it is prevalent in
India. So the you know, the friend of my friend, the enemy, what's that?
Exactly.
I've lost it, but you know
the enemy
I mean?
Of my enemy is my friend.
Is my friend. On that basis,
on
they
that
would
basis,
embrace
they would,
deep Southern Baptist fundamentalists.
That's right.
But of course, Hinduism is so extraordinary. I remember meeting some very senior, very revered figures from time to time who argued that Hinduism and atheism were not even oppositional. That there were many Hindu atheists.
So that's true. There is a very old philosophical tradition in Hinduism which allows for an atheist position. So it's that's not inconsistent with being Hindu at all.
What's your own cosmology? What's your own religious attitude?
I'm an agnostic.
Hindu agnostic?
I call myself culturally a Hindu because I was brought up as a Hindu. I'm a Gandhian kind of Hindu. I mean, Gandhi believed that all religions are an unstable mixture of truth and error, you know, and there's no superior or inferior religion, but accept the religion you're born into and try to interpret that religion in the most liberal, humanistic, just way possible. But I'm an agnostic. I don't adhere very strongly to any religious beliefs, but I'm not...
You're closer to Elwin than to Gandhi on matters of sexuality, I trust.
Well, not really. I'm sort of maybe in between. As I said, I'm a middle-of-the-road kind of position, so even on that, I'm sort of middle-of-the-road. I would say I am against extremism in all kinds of views. I'm against atheist extremism, too. I find Richard Dawkins a deeply unappealing figure.
And Christopher Hitchens' book is even more aggressive.
Well, I haven't read that yet. But
being Christopher, of course, that's inevitable, isn't
it? Inevitable. But Dawkins, you know, claims to be... I mean, a scientist with so much certitude and arrogance, you know, he reminds me of a religious preacher in his certitude and arrogance.
You're talking to an atheist who's really quite fond of both of them. But I concede your point in that they do get a bit grumpy.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's helpful.
That's not helpful. Yeah. And one of the interesting things about... I haven't read Hitchens' book... But one of the interesting things about Dawkins' book, Phil, since you mentioned Hinduism, is that he doesn't deal with Hinduism at all. Because, you know, he can't set up the same straw men when he comes to Hinduism.
It doesn't work.
Hindu philosophy is much too complex for him. Yeah.
Yes, and also, one thing about the Hindu faith is it has a vast sense of deep time. So you can't get into arguments about a 6,000-year-old world if you're talking to a Hindu.
No. Yeah.
Well, I like talking to this Hindu, agnostic Hindu, and I hope you have a wonderful time here at Adelaide's Festival of Ideas, and thank you for giving me some of it.
Thank you. It's been lovely.
That was the big voice of the man with the big ideas, Ramachandra Guha, talking to me at last weekend's Adelaide Festival of Ideas. We continue our coverage of the festival on our next, when I have a lovely chat with James Lovelock. Oh, next on ABC Radio National is the news, and we'll see you later.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.